This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. Our taping is made possible with the support of Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. Our podcast is also made possible with the support of our premier sponsor, IberiaBank. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. IberiaBank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. We're also grateful for the support of Lafayette General Health, who recently joined the Ochsner Health family and is now Ochsner Lafayette General. As one health system, Ochsner Lafayette General will provide expanded services and enhanced care from the familiar faces you already trust. Ochsner Lafayette General means more resources to help solve healthcare's toughest problems, reinvesting in our communities, and being further committed to health and wellness. Ochsner Lafayette General. Together means more. Learn more today at togethermeansmore.org. Our guest is Dr. Pearson Cross, well-known political analyst. Pearson is Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at UL Lafayette and an Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science. He is host of his weekly radio show, Bayou to Beltway, on KRVS 88.7 FM locally, that focuses on politics and policy. Pearson Cross is also a frequent commentator on political issues for news media at the national, state, and local levels. Early voting starts October 16th and will run through October 27th, preceding the November 3rd election. So it seemed like a good time to have Dr. Pearson Cross join us and discuss the political landscape here and across the region. Pearson Cross, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're in the middle of all kinds of things going on. Before we started taping, you were telling me that your classes are going on as normally as possible. You're teaching three classes, and you're doing them mainly on campus, some by Zoom.
Yeah, well, at UL, we have a few different designations. So we have face-to-face classes, we have high-flex, we have online, and we have remote. Mm-hmm. So really, it's been great. Students can pick what makes them comfortable. Instructors can pick the kind of classes that make them comfortable. Mm-hmm. So I'm interim head of political science as well. So some of those professors are really desire to have that face-to-face interaction in the classroom and won't give it up. And others are like, get me out of here. Mm-hmm. I want to do all online.
Yeah.
I'm kind of in the middle on that, you know.
I have a senior, as you know, you just met Kelly, and she really misses those in-person classes. There's nothing really beats being in the classroom, but given the times, I guess we're lucky that we've been able to move forward. So,
absolutely, and I feel bad for those people who are at those junior, senior, both in college or high school, because it seems like their capstone years are kind of being altered by this, mm-hmm. but I guess it goes with the territory.
I guess so. You know, 100 years from now, people will look back and talk about these days like we look back at the Spanish flu, and hopefully they'll have learned a lot. So
one hopes.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, what got you into teaching, and how did you end up here at UL Lafayette?
Well, it was a circuitous route. Both my parents were school teachers. My dad taught 8th grade science, and my mother taught elementary school and piano. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, grew up vowing that I would never be a school teacher. So what I wanted to do is be a musician. So I played piano and a number of other instruments, and was a music major when I first went away to college. And then didn't like school so much. It wasn't exciting enough for me. I was rather a free spirit. So I dropped out and started playing music full time. And I stayed out of college for about 10 years.
What type of music?
I was playing rock music, but I also played jazz and blues and different kinds of things. And I got on bands that traveled, so I traveled all over the western states. you know, doing one night stands or doing a week here, mm-hmm. a week there. And I did that for a number of years. And then my agent got me I auditioned for a sit down gig, as they would call it, in the San Francisco Bay Area, which was unusual because it was a 5 night a week job at a hotel in San Jose, actually, mm-hmm. and then later Palo Alto.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. And so that allowed me to live in the San Francisco Bay Area and also be a musician and have a steady income. So all of those factors kind of led me, I think, to have what's called a moment of clarity, where mm-hmm. I kind of went, huh, what am I doing and how is this working? And I kind of appraised my chances with a gimlet eye, as they used mm-hmm. to say, and decided that I better figure out something else. So that's when I went back to school, mm-hmm. and I was a junior when I went back to, I was just starting my junior year.
And how old were you then?
I was 29.
And that's really a good age, so mm-hmm. you got a lot more, you're settled and can focus.
Actually, I wasn't that settled.
You weren't
I wasn't
that settled.
Focused, but I knew I had to do something different.
I was trying to give you a break here.
Yeah, you were trying, but I ended up taking a political science class. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I was going to do, and I took a political science class, and I loved it. It made mm-hmm. sense to me. I found it interesting and compelling and all the things that you do, and I figured, okay, well, what do you do with a political science degree? I said, well, I'll become a lawyer. And then I took a couple of law classes at San Francisco State, which is mm-hmm. where I was at that point. And I realized that although I like political science, I'm not crazy about law or right. constitutional law. So, which left again the question, what are you going to do? And I had an influential mentor at the time who was a professor, actually quite famous professor that I didn't know at the time because undergrads aren't really aware of that, who said, well, why don't you get a PhD and teach? And
the one thing you didn't want to do.
Well, yeah, although, you know, it kind of went up to my parents because yeah. they had masters, but they didn't have PhDs. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, well, mm-hmm. you know. So I thought that sounded good. So I applied all over the country and got accepted at a number of places, but at Brandeis University in Boston, which is mm-hmm. a small kind of exclusive liberal arts school in Boston. And I went there and eventually emerged with a PhD in political science.
That's great. Mm-hmm. How did you end up in Louisiana?
Well, the market for people who do what I do, which is teach political science, is national. So when you look for a job, there's a magazine and a website now mm-hmm. where you look at job opportunities and departments list the openings they have, and the way they list them is by specialty. So, for example, when I was looking for a job, I was looking for a job as an Americanist who teaches state and local government.
Oh.
So other people would be looking for jobs like a political theorist or someone who does international relations or someone who does Asia mm-hmm. or something like that. So the job market is very focused. Mm-hmm. And then everybody who does that applies for that job. And then so I got an interview at ULM in the north part of the state, and mm-hmm. I went there and was there. So I got the job. So I came here, and then after 6 years, I moved down here to ULF. Yeah, a job opening opened up here, and I saw this as a more attractive opportunity in the southern part of the state. So
that's great.
So I came down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you really have a name statewide, I think, in the region for your political commentary, and I just admire that so much. I want you to know that, Pearson. It seems, you know, for someone like me, it'd be tough for me to say, this is what I think about this, you know, but you really, you have to analyze things, and you keep up with the trends, and we're in the middle of a crazy time right now. I mean, COVID has really thrown all these races up in the air, it seems, because everybody got shut down before they really had gotten their campaigns launched. Only one or two people that I know even had a big public event before they had to shut down everything. So with the election coming up, I thought it'd be interesting for you to kind of give your take on 2020, where we are, and maybe some lessons people are learning. Thank God for social media. Huh?
Well, thank God. We live and die by social media. I think, yeah, what you're talking about is that there were people who were up and running in January, February, before things got shut down in March, April. And those people, you know, got a chance to get their campaign going and get signed up. But for people who didn't, it's been really an odd season. Mm-hmm. And it's a season that's been kind of under the radar. It's a season that hasn't had a lot of face-to-face voter experiences. Obviously, Donald Trump has done some of that, mm-hmm. but of course, he's gotten COVID too, you know. So it's very hard to meet your people and very hard to get your message out. Now, as it turns out, that retail politics mostly is becoming less and less important because people are relying on face-to-face, less on face-to-face events and more on social media.
So retail is the old-fashioned...
The old-fashioned.
Stumping.
So think about...
Knocking on doors.
Yeah, Edwin Edwards running for office. Like, he would march in the rice parade, and then mm-hmm. he'd go march in the sweet potato parade, and then he'd go, you know, judge at something. And he's all over the state meeting everybody. People mm-hmm. are having events. He's doing 6 or 7 events a day. He's meeting thousands of people. That's pretty much done. At least right now, and particularly right now in terms of COVID, nobody's doing that. Mm-hmm. So the message has to get out other ways. And that's where, as you say, social media comes in.
Right. So for people, let's just take, you know, local elections. It's tough to raise money mm-hmm. in a good year. But to have this where you don't have the big events to sell tickets, how are people doing? I mean, have you been in touch with a lot of these candidates? What are they sharing, fundraising? Because I know they have to do some TV. They have to have some yeah. radio ads. You can't just be on Facebook and, you know, Instagram or whatever they're doing. How are they raising money?
Well, I think it's the Matthew principle. Those that have get, you know, and to those who are given, more is given. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's the sense. If you have a reputation already and people know about you and you have a fundraising operation, you can still develop money and you can get money. If you're starting out, this is your first race or something, and you need to start from a stop, mm-hmm. it's tough. Mm-hmm. How do you raise that money? How do you get your volunteers? Can you walk neighborhoods anymore?
But, you know, I've interviewed some candidates. Mm-hmm. They say they're walking, but I was kind of surprised because I just don't see people wanting to open the door to strangers, you know. But,
yeah,
but they say they're meeting nice people.
They you know? Are, and some of that's going on. I had somebody knock on my door. I was uh-huh. happy to see them, you know, and certainly some of that's going on, but less, mm-hmm. and people are reluctant to do that, I think. I think right now this benefits incumbents or people who are known. So mm-hmm. if you're running for an office and your name is already known, I think it's great for you. You can probably do less advertising. So, you know, if you're running an insurgent campaign against an incumbent, yeah. I mean, it's very tough.
Right. Mm-hmm. What are you anticipating? I know that early voting around the country, it looks like people are really early voting. And I don't know if I'm still accurate, but I saw in the news last week that overwhelmingly it's Democrats that are voting, you know, early in the states that have already had early voting. Mm-hmm. They're getting out yeah. to get their votes. What are you anticipating for us here in Acadiana and then Louisiana?
Well, let's talk about early voting a little bit. So I'm anticipating an unprecedented number of vote-by-ballot early voting. Currently, already more than 15 million people have voted across the country.
Wow.
So that's 1/10 of all the votes cast in the 2016 election, right?
Wow.
So it's an enormous number of people have voted. And the numbers right now we're doing about, states are doing about twice what they did in the last cycle. So mm-hmm. it's really super big. I think this is a net benefit initially to Democrats who are much more likely to run out an early vote and mm-hmm. to vote by mail and mm-hmm. do that. And I think there's a certain amount of enthusiasm on the Democratic side. So I think you're going to see early reports suggest a particularly enhanced turnout among minorities and women mm-hmm. so and young people. So I okay. think those are all factors that will the way the politics of it works will probably aid Democratic or liberal mm-hmm. candidates around the country. And those factors are still here, too. They're just a little more muted because this is quite a red state.
Right, right.
But so in Louisiana, I think we'll see major turnout here, mm-hmm. despite the fact that we really have no races of note except for the president.
Right. I've got a question about the mail-in ballots. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how it all fell out, but I know that there was a big push to not increase the ability of people to to vote by mail mm-hmm. because of the fear of fraud, which I'm not sure that was founded, but who can vote by mail-in ballot in Louisiana?
I think the way it says in Louisiana, and I don't think this rule has been changed, is that you basically apply for it mm-hmm. and you have a certain number of reasons why you can mm-hmm. do that. You're either coronavirus positive, or you have been, or you're quarantined, or you're mm-hmm. over 65, mm-hmm. or you have a recognized disability or something like that. Now, initially, I think the Secretary of State had advanced an idea that would allow anybody who wanted to kind mm-hmm. of apply for a absentee ballot and get it. But I think the legislature didn't like that very much.
Right.
So that was shot down. They changed it, mm-hmm. and then John Bel Edwards didn't like it very much, and that got shot down. So I think we're back to square one on that.
Where we've always been.
There are states that allow everybody to vote by mail mm-hmm. if they want. It hasn't been correlated with major fraud.
That's what I understand. Yeah.
Now, there occasionally, and this is the question between statistical or anecdotal evidence, is there any evidence, and I say any evidence, of an attempt to alter ballots? Yes. I mean, that's clear. They occasionally find that some votes were cast illegally or some votes were altered or this or that. Usually that's very, very, very small numbers. So mm-hmm. If you have 5 illegal ballots cast in an election when 30,000 people vote, that's troubling. You don't want any illegal ballots, but mm-hmm. it's generally not the kind of fraud that changes an election outcome.
Right. Although I do remember when Greg Davis ran locally for mm-hmm. school board.
Yeah.
I think he lost by 4 or 5 votes.
Yeah.
And one family could have made a difference mm-hmm. in that election.
Yeah.
So it does happen, and every vote does matter.
It's true.
But from what I understand, there's not this pervasive fraud that some people are fearful of.
No, and in fact, I've talked to Louis Perrette about this, our clerk of courts. Louisiana has a system where the votes don't get to the internet. So there's a data collecting box inside each voting machine that is specifically driven to Baton Rouge mm-hmm. or brought to Baton Rouge, and then those votes are harvested from that. It's a system that doesn't lend itself to hacking or to illegal casting.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that every state has a different system. So it's one of the strengths and one of the weaknesses of American government is that we practice federalism, division of power between state and national governments. So as a result, every state has their own election system. So, yeah, if you could figure out how to hack the mm-hmm. entire thing, that'd be great. But it isn't possible. You'd have to hack each state. And then you'd have to,
counties.
Like in Louisiana, mm-hmm. figure out how to hack each parish.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get down to there, it would take,
right.
It's impossible.
I'm wondering this year with the increased, early voting and then, of course, some increased mail-in ballots, this fear about the Postal Service not being timely. Mm-hmm. And when do we won't really have election results on the night of November 3rd, given the change in what's happening?
I do think we'll have election results on the night of
you
November
do?
3rd. Yeah,
I might think, be 2 or 3 in the morning. But like
yeah, well, I think the only way that we wouldn't have it would be if the election's very, very close. And if there's some particularly important swing states like the Florida or the mm-hmm. Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, Michigan are in doubt at that point.
Mm-hmm.
If the current poll numbers hold, it's not looking like that's going to happen. Now, if Donald Trump should have a resurgence in the polls, and he got back to within 2-3 percentage points of Biden,
mm-hmm.
then absolutely we could really have a delayed election, and it could, as President Trump has indicated, maybe it would end up before the court.
Yeah.
But if the current numbers hold, I don't really see that. Currently, mm-hmm. Joe Biden is heading for maybe not a monumental victory, but a fairly solid victory that's not going to leave much doubt. Now, if the numbers change, and they have changed before, and we're still 3 weeks out, and who knows what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
We could be in a much tighter situation. And then, as in last time, Donald Trump won that election by winning 70,000 votes in 3 states. Flip those 3 states, Hillary
right.
Clinton is the winner. So very tight margins.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a balancing act. If you see a teeter-totter, and it's balancing. This is a visual image, which probably won't work for your listeners. But if a teeter-totter is balancing between, fairly tight balance, it stays there until you unbalance it, and then it turns completely. And that's the way it works with vote margins, you know. So Ronald Reagan won a historic victory back in 1980. He won, I think, 400 and some Electoral College votes, which seems like, God, he just ran the table. Well, he did win, I think, every state but two or three. But there were lots and lots of votes for Dukakis, too. The actual vote margin between the two people was, 6-7%.
Yeah.
So it's not that big, but it creates, particularly in the Electoral College, magnifies the effect of the election
right.
itself.
Right.
So,
I had a question, and I don't know if it's putting you on the spot, but what if something happened to one of the presidential candidates, whether it was President Trump or Joe Biden or others, and they were not, either they passed away or were not able to perform the function of the office. Does the vice presidential pick, is that the person that would be in their stead? If this is before the election I'm talking about, let's say that President Trump had some really bad COVID complications, or Joe Biden.
Let's say Joe
would
Biden
have a stroke or
has
something.
A stroke.
Yeah,
and
how does
is
that
incapacitated.
Work?
As far as I know, they would still go ahead with the election as is, and then the 25th Amendment would kick in. And 25th Amendment, by the way, is a scary, scary amendment. If you haven't read it. Oh yeah, it's really scary.
I always hear about it in connection with Donald Trump.
Well, it provides for a coup. So it is a actual constitutional coup. So if the vice president and a majority of the members of cabinet certify to Congress that the president is not capable of fulfilling his or her duties, then the president is relieved of office and the vice president becomes president. And then, you know, but that can be overturned if, and then there are these chain of conditions, right? Yeah. But you really could see how a plotting vice president could, you know, spread rumors about a president or something. Of course, it was put there, and we've used it a couple of times, you know, with Nelson Rockefeller and back in the Watergate era, you know, with Gerald Ford ascended first to be take Spiro Agnew's place, and then he became president, and he used the 25th Amendment to, in fact, get Nelson Rockefeller in as vice president. And then, of course, he lost the election. So that's when we got Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
So for a little trip down memory lane.
I know. Well, I want to mention to people listening, I went on the Secretary of State's website, the Louisiana Secretary of State, and you can go to GoVote, G-E-A-U-X, vote. And I printed out, after I typed in my name, my date of the month and the year of my birthday, and my zip code, it gave me my ballot that I would be looking at. And Pearson, it's 6 pages long. I mean, I didn't even realize how many people were running for president, much less others. And Kanye West is running in the birthday party. And it looks like there's about 12 or so presidential candidates. But we've got a lot of elections to think about. U.S. Senate, U.S. Representative, district judges, city marshal, city court judges. We've got, and then how many amendments? We've got eight?
Seven amendments. And then a gambling one, yeah.
Yeah, so there is a lot coming up.
Yeah.
Where do you go to figure out, like, do you go to PAR or cable? Like, how do you find, like, about the amendments? Let's just start there. I think those are the hardest to figure out.
Yeah, the amendments very specifically, and I know our viewers can't see, but I printed out the PAR guide to the constitutional amendments, you know. And so I typically, I know Robert Scott and all those guys, Stephen Procopio, shout out. They have a chapter in my forthcoming book.
Oh, okay.
So on the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
So I go and see what they say about it. And, of course, it's, you know, always a mix of things. We usually have a few social kind of issues, which we do, of course, this time. Amendment 1, the question about should a right to abortion be found in the Constitution. But then we have a number of fiscal-type amendments that are in there, and those are standard, right? So far, we have 197 amendments to our current Constitution, and we're considering seven more this time. And, You know, of those, over 100 are actually just deal with the fiscal operation of the state. So that's the area that we really need to work on, I think. So it's if we should get a new constitution. In the meantime, you know, we're going to face all these constitutional amendments.
Yeah, I think people need to be prepared before they go in to the booth. You always need to be prepared, but this time, you know, with all the things we have to vote for, by the time you get to the end is when the amendments are there. And they're pretty complicated. And I've learned over the years, as you probably have too, you can look at an amendment and think it's very innocuous, and it can really pull a fast one on people. Yeah. I was thinking about the one about protecting nursing home funding, and by passing that, we've really limited funding for people to get home health care as they age in place. So it depends on what side you're on, but it can really be quite a blow if you don't know what you're voting for when you realize I voted for something I didn't really know what I was doing. So people should be prepared before they go in.
Boy, they really should. And the Public Affairs Research Council guide to the 2020 constitutional amendments is the place. Just type in PAR constitutional amendments, and it'll take you to that report. It's free. You can print it all out. So for our listeners, that's what I'd suggest.
Right. Do you see any major upsets? I know we have Senator Bill Cassidy. He's got some opponents. He's got quite a few opponents.
Yeah, 14 opponents.
Yeah. I know Adrian Perkins is probably the most well-known. Is that right?
Yeah, Adrian Perkins and Antoine Pierce are probably the two people who are looking to. They're both African-American politicians, one from Baton Rouge, Antoine Pierce, and Adrian Perkins from Shreveport. You know, and they are looking, I think, to make a statement. Democratic Party wants to run somebody. But also they're kind of, this is getting my resume out there and letting voters around the state know who I am.
And they're impressive.
I mean, definitely Mr. Perkins is impressive. I mean, West Point, Harvard Law, veteran.
Yeah.
You've got to say, wow, those are some credentials, right? And the other person, Antoine, is an NGO professional.
A non-governmental entity.
Non-governmental organization. It's acronyms.
Yeah.
The revenge.
And then, let's see, Clay Higgins has three opponents.
This is very interesting. There's KATC's going to, with a number of partners, including the ACA, one Acadiana, College of Liberal Arts at UL, and some other partners are going to, probably forgetting somebody, and I apologize up front. AOC Community Media is going to be putting on a forum for the representatives from the 3rd Congressional District. And I think that's coming up a week from today.
We can watch it. It's a virtual.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely going to be virtual. But but Clay Higgins isn't going to come.
Oh.
Because it's not a debate. So Clay said, supposedly said, I will attend a debate, but I won't go to a forum. So I've done a forum. I don't want to do any more this cycle, for what it's worth. So I think we'll have the two Democrats and Libertarian there. And then perhaps after that, if there is a runoff, then maybe a debate.
Right, right. And then we've got to see locally, let's see, district judge, two districts. Judicial races. Of course, the DA's race is a big, big choice here between two Landrys, Danny Landry and Don Landry.
Landry brothers, right?
Yeah, yeah, and they're both great guys. I mean, some of these are tough because you've got some wonderful candidates, you know, pitted against each other.
And that's the great thing about local politics is that, you know, I haven't heard a bad word about either one of these guys.
Neither one of them,
Don and Dan Landry. I think it's going to come down to who has the wider web of connections in the community. And,
And that's a three-parish. It's voted.
Acadia and Vermilion as well, I think,
I mean, they both live here, but they'll serve that 15th Judicial District. And then we've got an interesting race where Jules Edwards is a 27-year district court judge, and he wants to serve at the city court level to work with people before they get into big trouble with felonies, running against Michelle Odenay, an attorney that's well-known in the community. So we've got, you know,
that's an interesting race, because if there's a race that really shows the fissures in Lafayette, that should be it, because Jules Edwards, I think, is it's not controversial to say he'll probably do very, very well on the north side, upper Lafayette, so to speak. And Michel Odine is well known, on the south mm-hmm. side. And so we'll see a racial division on this. We'll see division, Republican and Democrat, so to mm-hmm. speak. And so it should be very interesting to see that, see where we are.
Yeah, because Jules is kind of a quiet worker bee. And I'm not sure if you're not in the legal community, if you really know a lot of these judges, a lot of the candidates. Yeah. Most people don't know them personally. So mm-hmm. it's another reason to do your homework. And then the city court marshal,
the city marshal race. Right.
I just can't wait to see how this comes out. And I think this week, Brian Pope just found out that he did not get a hearing at the Supreme Court. So his days, I guess, are closing in.
Brian Pope's saga is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been kind of a long and disappointing tale.
Yeah.
And
for the community, it's been disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And probably for him too.
I would imagine.
So, yeah. And so we've got that. And then the amendments. So I wanted to ask you if we can kind of segue. Mm-hmm. Our community has really had an interesting year so far, not only with COVID, but with the new administration coming in. And then we've got the Black Lives Matter movement gaining steam nationally, of course, but we've had a lot of action here in Lafayette. I wanted you to share your thoughts about where we are. From my perspective, we've lost some heavy hitter African-American leadership with Reggie Thomas leaving the police force, now running for city marshal, Senator Gerald Boudreau resigning and then retiring as head of Parks and Rec after having been in that department for, almost 40 years. We've really got a changing of the guard, and we've had so much upheaval. I just was curious to get your thoughts as a political analyst about where Lafayette is as we move forward in terms of leadership.
Well, in terms of leadership, I don't know. Josh Guidry, Guillory Guidry's. There are a lot of, Josh Guillory, our current parish and city parish president, he's clearly inexperienced. I think everybody can see that he's learning as he goes. He's trying to appeal to constituencies, and he's making mistakes. Now, I wouldn't be too harsh on Josh. Joel Robideau was prior to Josh, and he made a ton of mistakes too. And people who had known Joel from a long time were scratching their heads about mm-hmm. some of the things he did. So it may be just that it's a tough position and you got to appeal to a bunch of different people. There's some issues here, though. At a time when we really need leadership, some of the people you mentioned, Reggie Thomas, Gerald Boudreau, are going down, not able because of COVID or other reasons to, or they've reached that point in their life where they're kind of stepping aside. And then we get hit with all these issues. Mm-hmm. Now, the Mouton statue issue, of course, we had here. But then I don't think anybody anticipated the Black Lives Matter, the real full-throated takeoff. We saw a little bit of that with Alton Sterling, of course, the Baton Rouge incident. But then we had our very own incident, unfortunately, mm-hmm. of police shooting. And I think that really, the community really held its breath at that point and realized, I think what it's made everybody realize is that we're not immune from national issues and national pressures, and that we can't say, as we've often done, we're Acadiana, we're special, we're mm-hmm. exempt, we're immune.
Yeah.
Instead, we are part of the fabric of this America, and this America is divided in some ways, particularly along racial lines, along partisan lines, mm-hmm. and we have to deal with those issues. Nobody's going to come in from outside and solve it. We can't sweep them under the rug. Mm-hmm. Part of what adds sting to this, of course, is the economic stresses that we're feeling from both the oil downturn and from COVID. So one of the interesting things to me about the economic stresses is that lots of people are fine. There are people.
Isn't that amazing? Like, you see people buying houses and cars and
house sales in Lafayette Parish and are higher than they've ever been.
It's amazing
levels. So
yeah.
there are quite a few people who are really just fine. And then there are other people who are, mm-hmm. frankly, at the end of their rope. The unemployment's run out or is getting right. short. They're behind on their rent, their mortgage, mm-hmm. you know, their cars. It's really dire. And so we really have some serious issues, I think. And it's up the stakes on this election, I think, both nationally and statewide. But if I can say one last thing about national.
Sure. Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting about what's going on in the United States right now is that national politics is taking so much of the stage and so much of the news that it's crowding out local and state news. Mm-hmm. So we tend to spend more time thinking about Joe Biden and Donald Trump and the Senate.
Are the fly on Pence's head.
Yeah. Than we do about mm-hmm. whether or not we should fund rec centers on the north side. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we are, our attention is drawn mm-hmm. to the national politics. And it's always, of course, national politics has always been a part of our life. But now it just seems like there's this 24-hour news cycle. Yeah. It's riveting. We can't take our eyes off of it. State politics, by contrast, seems boring and parochial.
And it's very important. It affects us so much.
But it's very important, as you point out.
Yeah. Right. The other night, I was flipping channels, and I have to confess, we don't watch TV all the time. But I've been watching the debates, and it's just so predictable when you go from channel to channel, whether it's CNN or Fox or whatever. And I know locally, I've had people on the show saying, oh, everybody watches Fox News. And I don't really care to watch it. I want to be told what happened, and then I can figure out what I want to think about it, mm-hmm. you know. But some of these channels, and CNN and others, are the same. It's fed what they think, mm-hmm. you know, and you hear some of the news, but then it's about what they think about what that means. And it does seem locally, being such a red community, Republican driven, that people are watching TV and that's their engagement. And it's just like one way, my way or highway, whichever one you're watching. But it seems like more people locally watch the Fox News. And it just seems to affect everything from social media to our discussions, you know, with friends. I mean, what do you think about that? You think it's gotten worse and worse over the last 10 years?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely do. You know what, my Michael Henderson, who's the director of the Public Policy Center at LSU, who also has a chapter in my upcoming book.
We're going to talk about your book in a second.
Okay. He says that what we're seeing here is that we're not seeing a separating of Americans on the basis of belief or support for various issues, that we're still agreed about a lot of things and we're not at disagreement about a lot of things. So there is still kind of a bell curve in terms of public issue support, public opinion. Mm-hmm. What he says, where we're really divided, depends on which party we belong to. So partisanship is increased, whereas actual disagreement about issues is not so much. Mm-hmm. So there's a very tribal aspect to both Democrats and to Republicans. And if you're not in the right, if you don't identify with the markers of that tribe, those are the people that make you comfortable. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a shunning of the other side. And I think we're seeing that, like on your Facebook feed. If you're on Facebook, you may notice that a lot of people have weeded their feed over the election cycle as people decided, I just can't take anybody who's going to be a Trump supporter. Or other people said, I can't take anybody who's going to be a Biden supporter. And they kind of started unfriending people. Oh. And so I've seen that. I know I know in terms of my Facebook feed or my wife's Facebook feed or people I know, mm-hmm. people are just unfriending people now, just like bang, bang, bang. My wife crowed to me the other day that she had unfriended or snoozed 30 people and she felt better.
She did.
Although then she complained that her feed was boring. So
lighten the load, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, to me, it's so important to hear different perspectives because you always have room to grow and learn.
Absolutely.
But also, if you only hear what you want to hear, you can really be bamboozled.
Well, we're not doing what we should be doing, which is when we hear something that contradicts what we believe or what we think to be the case, mm-hmm. we need to examine that and say, instead of just going, oh, that's not right, or I don't believe that, or whatever, we need to look at and figure out,
Yeah.
Do they have something there? Is there some reason why I should reevaluate mm-hmm. what I believe about this case?
Yeah, where did they get their information
and try
to validate it?
So if you came out and you said that, for example, that learning was enhanced in single mother families, right? I would be, well, that's not exact single parent families, right? That's not exactly what I think about that issue or what I've been led to believe. What then you'd want to say, why do you believe mm-hmm. that? And you'd want to see the studies. And you kind of, so you constantly, particularly now, have to act as a fact finder.
Right.
So we're all doing that. And you have to, and the thing that I think people aren't doing is, when I see an ad or Facebook ad that really lines up with my personal beliefs, the initial step there should be distrust, not,
bingo.
that's bingo, there it is. Mm-hmm. Instead, it should be, I'd really like that to be true, is it? Mm-hmm. That's the step that allows you to get some distance. And I don't think enough people are doing that.
Well, one of the big issues I'm thinking of is the mask issue. You know, I've had the opportunity to moderate recently a large gathering of experts, like scientific experts, heads of the hospitals and all, and it was almost painful to watch them say, you know, people just, they're not trusting science like they used to. And these people are out there trying to save lives and not worry about if you're a Democrat or Republican. If you show up in the emergency room and you can't breathe, our dad is coding because, you know, his lungs are filled with COVID. And it seems like, I don't know if, it just seems that people that are labeled liberals think the masks are really important, and people that label themselves as conservative think that we can do without the mask or it's not important. And it goes against what I would think. You know, it seems like conservatives would be more driven by these are the rules and all, but I guess they don't want government telling them what to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I think the rest of the world has less of that. I think there's a little bit of it in Brazil, but in most cases, there's not a politics of mask wearing that has to do with the expression of individual rights.
Yeah.
So we take mask wearing and we put it in a frame of government can't tell me what to do.
Yeah, it's like the motorcycle helmet. Remember when people,
exactly.
they just didn't want to wear them.
Yeah.
It's like, well, there you go, but you're going to crack your head open.
Yeah, exactly.
Know?
And then the expression was, well, if I want to crack my head open, it's my head.
It's my choice, yeah.
It's my choice, right? So, and it's the same thing with the masks. I mean, the masks are proven to work. They are one of the steps, not the only step, to limiting the spread of COVID, which, by the way, is headed up again.
Is it?
In 40 states. Over 40 states are now heading up, and who knows where this one's going to end, or going to get to.
Yeah. I've been hearing more about people getting it, but fortunately, the ones I've heard about have not. They have had mild symptoms and seem to recover rather quickly. Not that that's everyone, but it does seem to be more widespread here, but not the serious cases we were hearing about, you know, back in March and April. And I guess the medical community's learned so much
since then about how to treat
people that do present with COVID.
Yeah, and if we could all get Donald Trump's treatment,
I'm pretty sure
we'd be doing fine.
I know.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, one of the things that people forget is that it's initially when the medical community was saying, don't worry about the masks, in part that was said because we had this enormous mask shortage. Mm-hmm. And people were buying up masks and medical professionals weren't able to get them and they really need them.
Yeah.
And so now it's changed. Now that we have adequate masks, people should wear them, you know, and that's a really important thing. But again, it seems like it's political, you know, and we can parse it and we can talk about it and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a firm believer in science, you know, and if science turns on its head and says, no, masks are not important, then I'll start believing that too. You know, it's just, I just don't want a politician to tell me what to believe about an epidemic.
Right.
You know, either so.
Well, Dr. Tina Stefanski and both the heads
She's been great.
Lafayette General and Our Lady of Lourdes have all said that, you know, the tough part about this COVID pandemic is that they have learned on their feet.
Yeah.
And so what they thought in March
was
different in April,
right.
It was different in May,
right.
And every month that goes by, every day, they're learning things that they didn't know, and they're they're having to
pivot. Having to readjust, yeah.
They're having to pivot daily.
Yeah.
And
I think people misunderstand what science is. You know, science is doing the most appropriate thing based on the knowledge that you have at a time. Mm-hmm. So if it seems like this at this point, and then you get data and that changes it, well, then science says, no, that's not what you do now. Now we've decided to do this. And everybody's experienced this with the doctor. You go to the doctor and you say to the doc, well, the last time I had this, you gave me this. And the doctor says, well, we're finding that this other is more effective. And you go, oh, okay. Yeah. So was science wrong before? No, but science is a developing kind of art and expertise. And I think people tend to think if it said it there and it says something else here, it's wrong. You clearly can't trust it. That's a misunderstanding of how it works.
Right. You think there might be a book in you down the line about how COVID has affected politics?
You know, I've thought about that. I have a book, coming out, I think, hopefully in the early year with a co-author, Dr. Christy Molloy at UL Lafayette. And this is going to be an exciting book. Mm-hmm. It's got chapters by 14 different experts on Louisiana politics, each one dealing with a different area.
The party is over, Louisiana politics in the 21st century by LSU Press.
It's going to be on LSU Press. Yeah. And it's going to be a chapter book. And we've got Jeremy Alford, who does LA politics, writing the chapter on the legislature. I'm writing the chapter on the governor. Mm-hmm. We have, as I said before, Parr, Robert Scott, and Steve Procopio on the Constitution. We got Bob Mann writing a chapter on communication. Mm-hmm. You know, Josh Stockley writing on elections. You know, so we've picked experts all around the state from Tulane, Southern, LSU, ULM, mm-hmm. UL Lafayette, and then some NGOs to write about very specific kinds of state issues.
The party is over. What prompted that title?
What prompted it is the things that are making Louisiana, or used to make Louisiana so unusual, are gradually fading away.
Such as?
The way we used to do campaigns, the way we used to tolerate corruption, mm-hmm. the way we used to not have all this slush money and we would not hold our politicians responsible, the way we seem to be immune to national trends and so on, all of that's changed. We've gradually become a fairly ordinary Deep South state. So whereas we used to be able to say we're not like Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia or Arkansas, the fact is from a political standpoint, we're very much like mm-hmm. those now. We're majority Republican. We have a mm-hmm. large black African American population that are Democrats. The majority here are Republican. We're a mm-hmm. low tax, you know, high poverty state. We're very much like the rest of the South. We used to be sui generis, you know, unusual, unique, but less so lately.
Although I do remember in my younger days, I traveled around the country and I did a lot of work in Illinois mm-hmm. and, you know, worked with politicians. I worked with their state government. And
they used to be pretty corrupt, too.
I found them to be very similar. I met some people and I thought, boy, if he had on a different wig, like a different toupee, that could be so-and-so. But yeah, most of the states, we were different from them. But between the oil and gas decline, and I guess term limits too, you've got that turnover mm-hmm. where there were a few holdovers.
Yeah.
But by and large, you really have a new set of people every 12 years now.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's been good?
Oh yeah, term limits is a big factor. We've really assorted ourselves out in terms of Republican and Democrat. We're moving. Mm-hmm. Used to be in the legislature. The legislature was nonpartisan.
It really was.
And now it's like, we've joined Washington. And, you know, there are just areas all over Louisiana where what made us special and different, mm-hmm. sometimes for good, sometimes for bad, are kind of disappearing.
Right.
You know, along with the coast, we have a chapter on the coast, and that seems to be disappearing too.
Right. It's been disappearing for decades, but we're really seeing it now. You know, I want to bring up the recent death of Governor Mike Foster mm-hmm. when you're talking about us being more nonpartisan in the past. I mean, he had been a Democrat, became a Republican to run. Right. He really was very conservative. Mm-hmm. Yet, when he ran government, he ran it for the people. I think he really worked as a nonpartisan governor that looked to fund education. He cared about the environment. Mm-hmm. He did a lot to start the community college system. He did, I think, what started the workers' compensation, Louisiana Workers' Compensation Commission. He did more than almost anybody, and he did it working across the aisle. And do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, do you think we can return to that type of, you don't see any hope for that? He's shaking his head, no.
Yeah, Governor Foster was an amazing guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he hadn't run for office, I think, until he was 58 or something like that. And I had the opportunity to meet him a couple of times, and then also be, moderated a discussion with some of the people that were in his administration down in Franklin. And that was just a lot of fun to meet people who had really, you know, come up with him and been parts of his administration. And they all spoke so highly of him. But Governor Foster was great. I mean, he was very much a pragmatic, no nonsense, no politics, no BS kind of guy.
Yeah.
Famously, you know, he would get up and give a 2-minute speech and say, okay, well, that's all I got.
Yeah. You know? And people loved it.
You know? Yeah. And he was very effective. He was a great friend to higher education. Mm-hmm. He started with TOPS and with the community college system and other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You know, he was, despite being conservative, you know, he, I think, was instrumental with Steli and getting Steli going.
Steli Plan,
Steli Plan, which for a little while seemed to, before it got ousted, was doing some things that national, you know, tax experts had said we needed to do, like eliminate taxes on milk and groceries and some other kinds of things.
Yeah.
People tend to forget that that was the trade-off there.
Yeah,
you know?
Higher income tax.
Right, changing the categories in income tax, but getting rid of some of these taxes that the poorest and standards were just like saying, you guys are in bad shape. So he was really an amazing person, but I don't know if we'll see his like again. I will say John Bel Edwards, for a Democrat in the state, is trying very hard to be middle of the road and to work with both sides, both parties. I think he's in a different environment now. I think there's much less trust. I think the legislative leadership, Lance Harris and Paige Cortez, not so much Paige, but generally speaking, I think the Republican majorities in House and Senate are much less trustful of his intentions and there's more oversight. But I think it's hard to imagine someone who is not of a member of the majority party doing a better job of trying to make it about Louisiana and not about a political party.
And he's really been hit with some major acts of God between the flood in 2016 and these hurricanes and COVID. I'm sure there's things I'm not even thinking of, but he does, you know, he has been a stable leader.
He has.
And I know you can disagree with him on, you know, oil and gas and coastal lawsuits, but he's been a good leader for catastrophes and the people.
Particularly when compared with other state leaders in Georgia or Florida or some of those other states that seem to, you know, have a new policy every morning, you know, in some areas. And he really seems very, like a very steady hand on the tiller. Mm-hmm. So to speak. And I think people are comfortable with that. I don't think we're going to elect a Democrat as governor to follow him.
No.
But I don't think it will be a judgment on John Bel Edwards that that we don't. I think by and large, the fact that he got elected in this, that he got reelected in this state is says something about reaching across the aisle and appealing to people who weren't Democrats.
Right. Mm-hmm. Were there any questions you thought I would ask you that I haven't? Anything you wanted to bring up?
No, I guess the thing that, like everyone else in the United States, I'm really wondering what the post-election settlement will be after the dust clears. Where are we going to be? Of course, so much is up in the air. I know so many people that are walking around holding their breath, you know, and just thinking, oh, my God, are we going to, you know, is this
civil war?
Yeah, are we going to descend into civil war? Other people who are Democrats are saying, oh, my God, I want to move if we get 4 more years of Donald Trump. I'm hearing that a lot from liberals. I'm hearing dire warnings of from Republicans who are talking about, you know, what Biden or Harris might do, you know, pack the court, do all these kinds of things. So I'm very, very hopeful that the temperature drops off a number of notches after this election is over, mm-hmm. and that everybody kind of catches their breath and realizes that we're all Americans and that we need to create the country we want as we move forward. And you have to do that with people who don't believe the same thing. Yeah. You have to compromise. You have to bring people together, not push them apart. Mm-hmm. I think if there's any lesson of the Trump campaign and candidacy is that we do better with a uniter than a divider. Yeah. And I have to say, if I were to say one thing about Donald Trump, I don't think he's a uniter. I think Donald Trump, personality-wise and focus, looks for a way to push against conflicts, against faults, against issues. And I don't necessarily think that that's a great quality in our president.
Yeah.
Some people think that's truth-telling. I personally think it's stepping on corns. That people, you know, we need to be brought together, not driven apart. Mm-hmm.
He's done a lot of good things, and I think it's mainly overwhelmed by the Twitter feed and the divisiveness, as you're saying. And it's really a shame because he's really brought a lot of good things to the table to help people, you know, prescription drug issues, and he's tried to do the right thing, but it's overshadowed. By
his personality and the tweeting and the and the kind of thing he can't seem to resist. I mean, his consultants tear their hair out. They can't get him to stop.
Oh, can you imagine being his spokesperson?
He would be running easily to re-election, you know, had he won two things. One, had he handled COVID a little differently, I think, initially, that would be good. And then had he not had the personality trait of adding gasoline to fire.
Yeah.
You know, which he just can't seem to help himself, you know, and it is what it is. That's why some people love him, you know, but it's also why probably a majority is going to vote against him.
Yeah, we'll see. It's going to be interesting.
It is.
So, well, Dr. Pearson Cross, again, Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Professor in the Department of Political Science at UL Lafayette, I want to thank you for taking time to be on Discover Lafayette and reminding people that we can early vote October 16th through the 27th, and you can go vote not just downtown at 1010 Lafayette Street, but there's two other places to early vote, the Martin Luther King Recreational Center at 309 Cora Street, and then the East Regional Library in Youngsville at 215 La Nouvelle Road. So people have more options now, and I think you can vote like 8 in the morning till 7 at night, I read in the paper. So it's extended hours every day but Sunday. So we've all got plenty of opportunities to go quietly cast our ballots. And I want to thank our sponsors also, Iberia Bank, Lafayette General Health, and Raider, of course, for making our podcast possible these past few years. And thanks to our listeners, please visit discoverlafayette.net. You can find Dr. Pearson Cross's interview and over 170 other interviews. Or even better, you can go to your device and click the little podcast app and you can subscribe to Discover Lafayette and have it delivered to your phone or device every Friday. We'd appreciate you telling people about the podcast. And if you'd like to suggest guests, I'm really open for people that you think would be interesting. So you can contact me through the website or jan@janswift.com with your ideas. Thank you for listening to Discover Lafayette.